Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where each week I am joined by pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. This week, I've got the pleasure of actually welcoming back a former guest and the founder of ArrowDX in Edward Alano. And he is kindly joined by Dr. Sanjeev Chopra. So, Edward, Sanjeev, welcome to the podcast. Keen to hear, I guess, what you've been up to. Because I know, Edward, you and I spoke off air and you gave me a bit of a heads up. But since I guess you were first on the show, if you could kind of just maybe give us a quick recap on ArrowDX and the work that you've been doing, and then we'll jump into some of the new ventures that you're involved with.
Sure. Thank you, James, for having us on the show. Thank you, Dr. Chopra, for taking time out of your busy schedule. So, a recap, ArrowDX, it combines nanotechnology and machine learning, and we've created a mobile diagnostic platform. Our product is called the Arrow Test. What is it? It's a glass slide with proprietary nanoparticles that enhance the signal detection. And so it's a broad platform, but we've been focused for the last few years on fatty liver disease, and Dr. Chopra is a renowned expert in that. And it's something that's I firmly believe is a big problem, right? And so, working together with our medical advisors as well as our scientific advisors, the goal is to create an early test for this disease. Now, so there's a chemistry aspect to it. We're a very chemistry intensive company, startup. But we've also been working since I last spoke with you, James, been working on machine learning. And I know that's a very AI machine learning, something very popular these days. But in chemistry, it hasn't been used that much in physical chemistry, analytical chemistry. And so what we're doing is we're trying to create an algorithm that can predict features ahead of time. So, like, let's say that the customer or the researcher or the physician has a sample and they know that they're searching for some protein, some enzyme. But in blood there's so much stuff, right? That sometimes the signal will get swamped or reduced in size. So by using machine learning, we're trying to predict these features ahead of time. So then the customer or the researcher, physician will know exactly where to go, right? And that's something that has not been done with Raman spectroscopy. If we continue on this pace, it'll be a very novel thing. Very few researchers have tried combining spectroscopy with machine learning. It's fairly new to do that.
So how did you come across this space? If not many people have kind of done this previously, how did you end up getting into this? I think when you were last on the show, I asked you again about your background and how you fell into this space. But how, now that there's something new on the cards that you're working with, how did you get into this area?
Well, I've been very fortunate the last 2 summers to work with brilliant young students from UC Berkeley. They were computer science students. So last summer I was the privilege of working with two students, and I'm going to mention their names because they're very great students. Arnav Gupta and Yang Jing Chen, both computer science students as well as double major in biology. And so they told me, "Hey, Edward, let's apply the machine learning to Raman spectroscopy." And I'm like, "I'm not too sure." I did a literature review and I said, "Well, a lot of researchers are having trouble doing it, right? Because you need a lot of data. And anytime you work with AI, you just need lots of data to refine the algorithm." And so last summer, and they were working with some of our data and also our data of a collaborator or an advisor. And they got some good preliminary results, right? So that got me more interested in it. And then I spoke with someone that I know in academia, a professor at UC San Diego, and I asked her, if we're able to predict 90% of the structures in a sample, is that novel? She was like, "Very, very novel." I think, people claim AI and machine learning does a lot of great things, and it does, but you need data. Without data, any algorithm is going to fall apart. And so these two young students really got me into it last summer. I'm a chemist by training. I love chemistry. I love working in the lab. When it comes to computer science, my background is very minimal. I mean, I can program a little bit, but that's about it, right? But AI machine learning is just so powerful if it's used properly.
Sure. And you mentioned, I guess, that this will help physicians to know where to go almost ahead of time. Dr. Chopra, I'd be keen to get, I guess, your take on this, and just have I guess, a bit of input from yourself as to kind of your thoughts on precisely that, whether how useful you feel it's going to be, how it's going to change the game, perhaps.
Yeah, so I'm a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. I've written 15 books, and I've carved out an interesting parallel career in speaking and writing. And I give keynotes all over the country and in different parts of the world. And one of the recent keynotes I've developed is called Lifelong Learning, Through the Rearview Mirror and a Peek Ahead. And in the peek ahead, I start with a quote by Niels Bohr, Nobel laureate in physics, who about 100 years ago said, "Predictions are difficult, particularly those about the future." But now I'm going to hazard, and the five biggest stories playing out in medicine and biological sciences are artificial intelligence. We should really probably call it aided or augmented intelligence, a better term. Microbiome, the gut microbiome, the 100 trillion bacteria in our gut that have implications in every disease, including autism and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and cirrhosis and arthritis, response to chemotherapy, side effects of chemotherapy, and so on. Messenger RNA, basis of the COVID vaccine, gene editing, and then believe it or not, the psychedelic revolution with magic mushrooms and ketamine and so on, changing the landscape. So AI in medicine, the doctors of the future who will not use AI will be obsolete. And the doctors of the future who will use AI incorporated into their work will be smarter doctors. Now, here's an amazing study from Mayo Clinic that looked at 5,210 patients that came to liver transplant, right? End-stage liver disease. And they had 27,500 matched controls. And somebody decided to look at their EKG and incorporate AI. And it comes out with a score and it says severity of liver disease. This person is ready for a liver transplant. And after the liver transplant, the EKG reverts to normal. We don't even know how it does it. So we call it machine thinking, deep think, machine learning. Absolutely incredible. It's possible in the future that I'll see a patient with liver disease, send them next door to get an EKG, incorporate AI, and say, "You're doing okay, I'll see you in a year." Or the next patient, I'll say, "I'm sorry, you have very advanced liver disease. We need to meet with the transplant team." There's another study looking at chest X-rays, incorporating AI, and it says, "This patient has type 2 diabetes." Unbelievable. Another study looking at abdominal CAT scans done for gallstone-related problems or diverticulitis. It says this patient, that patient, and that one likely to develop pancreatic cancer 5 years from now. It's incredible. So it's changing the landscape. And I think if non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, there's a new term for it now. It's called metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. But nevertheless, we can stick with
Does that
MASLD.
come with a new acronym then that everyone's
Yeah,
going to
MASLD, MASLD,
need to
macro metabolic associated steatotic, which means fat liver disease. So the estimate is that 1.5 billion people in the world have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And there's a spectrum. To just having extra fat in the liver, to having fat and inflammation, to developing cirrhosis. And then once they develop cirrhosis, they're at risk for all the complications, including development of primary liver cancer and the need for a liver transplant. We have 3-year-olds in America who have fatty liver, the first stage, 16-year-olds with scarring, and 28-year-olds getting a liver transplant. So who has this condition? People with what we call metabolic syndrome, obesity, type 2 diabetes, high triglycerides, insulin resistance. And we are seeing a burgeoning epidemic of that condition. In America,
they're not extreme conditions by any means, by the sounds of things.
That's correct.
Wow.
And a lot of people are not even aware that they have this condition. And a lot of primary care physicians, GPs, do not understand and are not aware of this condition. They see liver tests that are slightly elevated. They say, oh, nothing to worry, we'll follow you. But in fact, the height of the liver enzymes does not necessarily correlate with severity. And that patient may already have advanced scarring or even early cirrhosis. So I think there are three challenges. The first challenge is we need to create greater awareness about this condition all over the world. All over the world. That's the first step. The second is if we can have a test that can non-invasively figure out the severity of the liver disease in these individuals, that will be amazing. Mm-hmm. Right now, we often resort to liver biopsy, which is invasive, can have complications.
Yeah.
Or we do a test called FibroScan, which measures liver stiffness or elasticity and correlates the amount of scarring in the liver. But a simple at the point of care test, which would tell us the severity of this condition, would be amazing. And then the third, of course, is treatment for this condition. At the moment, the only effective treatment is weight loss.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's baffling that, as you say, that people can almost have this and not be aware of it. And I guess this testing is essential, as it may be, in order to reduce this condition. So I guess since you guys kind of got into this new space and have added the AI or machine learning element, how has that opened your eyes? Because Dr. Chopra, you mentioned there that if you're not keeping up with this, you know, these new trends, this new technology available to us. And I spoke to somebody on the show a while back talking about Harvey Castro. He was talking about ChatGPT in healthcare. And he was saying exactly the same thing. You know, a physician who's saying if any physicians that don't adopt this are going to get left behind. So how has it gone for you guys at Arrow DX since you started bringing this into the business?
To that question to Dr. Chopra and myself.
Oh, go, Edward, you go ahead.
Either of you. Yeah, I guess you're the experts here.
Like I said again, I think Dr. Chopra hits the points really, really well. AI, machine learning has opened my eyes of how that tool can be used to be predictive and be in enhance the detection. So, you know, one of the struggles with just having a normal chemistry test is that reproducibility, right? I mean, nothing is 100% reproducible. And even more so when you work with bodily fluids. And so with the incorporation of machine learning into this test, we at Arrow DX feel is really important. If we can get it to the point where we can predict 90% of the structures in a reproducible fashion, and then test this out in a clinical environment as well. You know, right now the validation is just in a lab environment. You know, we give the data to the algorithm, but if we can go through clinical trials and have that reproducibility, it's going to be very, very powerful, right? So to me, it's opened my eyes. You know, if you would have asked me a few years ago, well, how do you feel about computer science and machine learning? I'm like, it's there. I sort of understand it. But I've gained a greater understanding, greater respect. And I really owe that to those two students I had last summer. You know, I think one of them will be graduating from Berkeley next year. And the other one already graduated from Berkeley this past semester.
Wow.
But those are brilliant young minds, you know, and I hope I can recruit them back to Arrow DX next year. So I think it's powerful. Like I said, Dr. Chopra hits the points really, really strongly. I think any physician, any scientist in general, especially an experimental scientist, I consider myself an experimentalist, will need to incorporate AI into their work, you know, and understand it and use it properly. And I think that takes time. You know, I'm still learning, but obviously.
One of the things that's very telling is that 12 years ago, there were 12 clinical trials on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in the United States.
Mm.
And last year, there were 450 clinical trials registered.
Wow.
I tell all the young hepatologists, my specialty is liver disease, hepatology.
Mm.
I tell all the young and upcoming hepatologists, focus your work, whether it is basic science or clinical, on this dominant chronic liver disease, non-alcoholic liver disease. I have a colleague, Michelle Lai, at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She was one of our fellows and is now an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Med School. Brilliant.
Mm.
And she is in charge of all the NAFL trials at our center. And she's running about 15 clinical trials.
Wow.
So we're going to learn a lot. And I think as we go forward, we have to incorporate AI. And that will be absolutely huge.
Yeah, no, as I say, I've spoken to a few physicians, a few people that have said exactly the same thing. What do you feel that there's going to be a pushback on this from people that are used to the old methods, the more traditional side of things? I mean, you both, you know, Edward, you've been very open to say, look, I knew that this type of thing existed. Dr. Chopra, I mean, you seem very open-minded to it and like, you know, is it a case of your own mentality, or do you think that there's going to be reluctance to adoption from others?
Well, I tell you what, I have a saying, the mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open.
Mm.
Right? So we need to have an open mind about this. And one of the things that's happening in medicine, which is very sad, is the rate of what's called burnout. Physicians are feeling spiritually, physically bankrupt. They're exhausted.
Mm.
Some of them are leaving medicine as a profession. You know what AI is going to do for that? It's going to be a solution. The average physician in America, primary care physician or a specialist, sees patients all day, maybe does procedures, and then spends 2 to 2.5 hours later in the evening or sometimes from home, filling out the paperwork, dictating the reports, getting the insurance to approve and get paid. It's now going to be done by AI.
Mm.
If I'm going to be seeing a patient, as I'm talking to the patient, someone's going to be recording it. And by the end of that visit, there'll be a dictated note, which I'll send. The billing will be done.
Mm.
And the primary care physician will get a referral letter. So physicians, when they see this happening, it's already happening in some places. One of the other examples of AI is mammography for breast cancer detection.
Mm.
The mammographer may have seen 5,000 mammograms, but AI can incorporate 1,000,000. The mammographer on Tuesday afternoon is tired. We're human. We're going to make errors. AI is not going to make errors.
Mm.
Already, patients are being offered mammography incorporating AI with a 20% increase in the charge, which right now the insurance companies are not paying, but they will start to pay because it'll be a better test.
Mm.
And many patients are opting for it. So it's going to change the way we practice medicine. It's going to address burnout. I don't even like that term. I think we should call it system-induced distress or moral injury. It's going to address that, and physicians will be happier and more productive and stay in the profession.
No, I like that. I think a very good summary, and I absolutely love the analogy of the parachute.
Yeah.
And keeping an open mind, like absolutely spot on. And
you know, the other great thing is by Schopenhauer, a German philosopher, who once said, all truth goes through three phases.
Mm.
First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident. We always knew that coffee was good for you. We always knew that AI was an amazing thing that we should all embrace. So it'll happen. It'll take some time, but it'll happen.
I think, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I've even been the same. I mean, but even things like note-taking on things like this. I mean, we're recording this via a video call, but the note-takers where I can come off as a recruiter nowadays and have all of the notes immediately there without having to do anything is incredible. And the same can be used in a physician setting. So I like that thing about the open-mindedness. Now, Edward, probably to flip things back to yourself here, since I guess keeping an open mind yourself, how have perhaps the business goals or vision changed since you and I last spoke? Because it must be at least 18 months, maybe even 2 years.
About
So
been about 18 months. This new technique that we're working on, I think will enhance our company, make it more attractive to secure funding. And I think one of the challenges that any diagnostic company has at the early stage, like AeroDx, is it's diagnostics is one of the things where there's a long return on the investment. So the majority of investors and venture capitalists tend to shy away from DX. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, we saw during the pandemic how important it is to have accurate testing, right?
Of course, yeah.
And so, but I think AI machine learning can maybe bring that extra validation or that extra icing on the cake that's needed to bring some of the business folks and strategic partners on board. We've been very fortunate to have some that machine learning just pop in like it did for us. And right now, I'd say that our push is still on a lab test. But we're not ignoring machine learning AI. And if anything, this summer I have a new group of interns that'll be joining that little group. So I think it's making us more open, versatile to the changes in technology. And maybe that's what was needed for us to gain more traction, right?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the point that you make there with the funding, I guess, it's not been a great period for the pharma and biotech space in general on the funding side of things of late. But when you bring in that AI element, it's just perhaps maybe a bit sexier for funders who are like, oh, okay, now we've got this, but we've also got the AI and machine learning tools. The young funders out there are perhaps thinking, okay, look, let's pay a bit more attention to this. Do you think that's a fair comment or?
I think it is. I firmly believe data speaks for everything. I mean, the more data you have, the more attractive you are to anybody, whether it's an investor, a strategic partner, a potential advisor. Data speaks for everything. Sometimes, the data may need refinement. So obviously, data and machine learning will make things more attractive, right? I mean, if I were sitting on the other side of the table, if I were an investor, the more data I see in front of my eyes, the more likely I am to become a partner and investor.
No, definitely. I guess it helps you make an
I
informed
think
decision.
you hit it right on the head, Edward. That's very important. I think the other thing that will possibly help with investors is telling a story. Storytelling is very important. Steve Jobs once said, storytellers are the most powerful people in the world. And so as part of your pitch, if you tell a story, which has to be true, authentic, that my, 62-year-old aunt had type 2 diabetes and hypertension, and then she developed this liver complication, and then she wound up getting a liver transplant, it will resonate for people. Because if 1.5 billion people have it, there are many rich people and investors who have some family member with this condition. And it has to resonate for them. And then they have an extra incentive to do funding. Lee Iacocca endowed a chair at Harvard Medical School worth $4 million to Ron Kahn, a brilliant endocrinologist, diabetologist. Why? Because his granddaughter had type 1 diabetes. So it's usually something personal like that that often clicks for investment.
I think so. It's that relatability, isn't it?
I agree 100% with Dr. Chopra's comment. I was pitching to an angel group out of the Boston area last week, and it turns out that one of the members of that group said, my 18-year-old son had a scare, and his liver enzymes were very elevated. So, he's like, I'm really aware of fatty liver disease now, even though the person doesn't have it. He was, he
Yeah,
just
good.
it got him aware of everything. As Dr. Chopra will say, diet's so important. I think since I became aware of fatty liver disease, I'm glad that, I met Dr. Chopra through some common contacts that we have. I watch my diet, not that I wasn't watching it, but I tend to, if I see something that I know I shouldn't eat, I won't eat it, right? And I've also, exercise is so important, exercise and meditation. Dr. Chopra, I'll let him talk about that. I've and coffee. I got into coffee due to Dr. Chopra as well. But I think even though those things are really important, you still need a test, right? And we have a broad platform, and now our broad platform has AI machine learning in it. So we're focused on fatty liver right now. People ask us keep asking us, Edward, what's in the future? So, well, let's first get this done as best as we can to either bring in another partner, a pharma company, or get this test to market if possible, and then we'll look at other things, right? I mean, people have knocked on my door asking me, well, Edward, how about looking at prostate cancer, looking at other things of that nature, right? And so, like I said, we can't do four or five things at one time, but there's still a lot of potential in our platform. AI machine learning is going to make it even better.
Amazing. Now, you must have read my mind there, Edward. That was a couple of questions that I was thinking of. You literally just asked them about bringing in partners, what's next, etc. You can tell that you've been on the show before. Awesome. Well, look, with that in mind, then I guess that kind of wraps things up in terms of what's happened, what you've been up to. I guess one that maybe you perhaps hadn't thought of is, do you envisage any big challenges, or what do you think is going to be the main challenge in order for you to get from where you are now and things have changed slightly to where you want to be in a couple of years, and with
Well,
the
I think our main challenge right now, we're in the middle of fundraising. I also relocated to San Diego, California. I'm 100% back in San Diego. Last year my mom passed away, and so I think I told you that, James. And so I moved back with my family here in San Diego. So I think, right now we're in the middle of fundraising, but we have to go through the regulatory aspects, right? I think that is I don't see it as a major challenge. I just see I need to bring the right partners to help me with the commercialization. I've learned a lot about business over the last few years as being a startup founder of a company, working with a lot of people. But commercialization, as well as regulatory hurdles that are coming up in the next 12 months for us, that'll be a challenge. But nothing that can't be overcome with the right partners, the right advisors. I think, and also the economy. The economy, it has its ups and downs. And so it's hard to predict where we're going to be a year from now, economic wise. But I firmly believe that, the more data we have, the more validation we're doing with AI machine learning should make us put us in a good place, in the next 12 months.
Sounds like it. And I guess with both of you keeping that open mind, as you say, you don't know what's going to happen in a year. None of us saw COVID coming, and that was a big theme that you and I discussed last time you were on the show. So
I mean, for
who knows,
me,
right?
when I started AeroDX, I started it a few months before COVID, and I rented lab space at night, and I did some proof of concept where I lived, and then I think I was in Boston 2 weeks before the shutdown, and I came back from Boston, and all of a sudden everything just shut down, right? And so it hit everybody like a rock, and no one saw it coming. At least I didn't see it coming. But we got through it. And now there's all we can do is focus on the future. And I'm so glad to be working with Dr. Chopra for many reasons. He's an expert, but most importantly, he's taught me about the way he talks about positivity and meditation, and always being thankful for what you have and how much progress you've made, and just having that open mind, right? I mean, I'll let Dr. Chopra make some final
I was
comments. He's
gonna
better
say
than me.
on that piece. Look, I can't remember, Edward, if I was running quick fire questions at the end of shows when you were last on. But Dr. Chopra, you've already amused me or kept me entertained with some of your analogies and things to this point. So I'll perhaps hit you with a couple of quick fire questions to maybe close up the show here. And one that I always ask guests is about if you were to perhaps give any advice to your younger self, what would that be?
So, Mark Twain famously once said, the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. I wrote a book about this.
Mm-hmm.
Two most important days, how to find your purpose and live a happy and healthy life. I give a keynote around the country. I just gave a talk to 9 of the top wealth managers in America in the Creek, Colorado. So it took me a while to find my purpose. Actually, a spiritual friend of mine 20 years ago said, Sanjeev, you won this award, you wrote this book. I said, Adrian, where's this conversation going? You know all this. He said, what is your purpose in life? And I never thought about it. I thought about success and how to accomplish success and how it's a journey and how you need to have grit. And now everything I do has to be aligned to my purpose. Otherwise, it's a detour or a distraction, no matter how much fortune or fame it might bring. So if I had to talk to a younger self, I would have said, hey, find your purpose in life. And I tell a lot of stories about young people in their 17-year-olds and 20-year-olds who've found their purpose in life and are changing the world.
Wow.
So that would be what I would tell myself. Now I'd share it with kids. I was on a show about finding joy in life with kids from all over the world and parents. And this 7-year-old girl from Romania was the first one to ask a question. And she said, you talked about the importance of friends, but I have this friend and he's always nasty to me. And how should I deal with him? And so I told her what to do. And then some of the topic of mirror neurons came up and she raised her hand. She said, yeah, I know about mirror neurons. 7-year-old girl in Romania.
Wow.
She said, when you smile at a newborn baby, the baby smiles back at you. It's not because they're that intelligent, but the same neurons that are firing in you when you're smiling are firing in her brain and leads to a smile. I mean, these kids are so brilliant. So my greatest thrill is when I talk to young students, young people.
I like it. And with that in mind, then I think I may have asked Edward and Murph previously, but what would you say is your number one rule then for life and business? Is it around that purpose piece, or is there anything else that you would add to that?
My purpose in life, which I've articulated and I've put it in my talks and in a book I wrote, is to fulfill my dharma, which is a Sanskrit word that incorporates moral compass, vocation, authenticity, and truth. To fulfill my dharma, to teach medicine, to teach about leadership, to teach about happiness, to do it grounded in humility, with an ardent desire to learn every single day, to celebrate with gratitude my family, my friends, my colleagues, my students, and my patients who inspire me in countless ways, and in some small measure, inspire everyone I meet on this amazing life journey. So it's a little long, but I wanted all those four elements in there.
Amazing. No, I like that. And look, Edward, I guess to close things off here, I asked you previously, but for anyone, whether it's investors, potential future interns, etc., anyone wanting to learn more about yourself, Dr. Chopra, ArrowDX, what's the best place to check you guys out?
The best place is our website, www.arrowdx.com. It's a new website. It's been up a little over a year. And also, you know, through the website, they can email me. And they can also find me on LinkedIn. You know, either one is fine. I think, you know, any, you know, they can contact me through LinkedIn or through the website. You know, they'll usually hear with me within a day or two. But we're very open to talking to anybody that wants to work with us. And I believe in collaboration. You know, one of the things I learned in my career as a young student was that you have to work with all types of people, right? Everybody brings a different viewpoint to solve the problem. And I think that's what makes science beautiful, getting to work with physicians, physicists, biologists, computer scientists. Everybody will look at the problem differently. And all of a sudden, oh, wow, that's a solution, right? Sometimes when you work with one type of scientist, you know, and I'm guilty of that when I was younger, I thought that my solution was the only solution. There's often more than one way to solve the problem.
Most definitely.
The other way could be much better.
Most definitely. Well, look, gents, thank you very much for joining me on the Huxley Morton podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you,
Thank you
James.
so much. Delighted. All the best.